Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions, a local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When Amazon announced it was looking for a site to build a second headquarters earlier this fall, New Hampshire and many other states were quick to say, pick me. But while most people don't expect the Granite State to be selected, all the chatter and speculation did highlight some holes in our economic development pitch. For example, where would a new corporate headquarters find employees? Businesses already struggle here to find good workers. And where would they live? Housing is already very tight in the Granite State. Also, what about transportation? If a bunch of new employees moved in, could the roads handle the traffic, given our limited public transit? It's our economic news roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you as we cover these issues of housing, transportation, workforce development. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. Jeff Feingold is here, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good seeing you, Laura.
Also with us, Russ Tebow, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm based in Laconia. And Russ, welcome back.
Thank you.
Also with us, Brian Gottlob, principal of Polycon Research, an economic research firm based in Dover. And Brian, thank you for coming in.
Morning, Laura.
Well, before we get into this Amazon bid bringing up other longstanding economic development issues, including rail, which is a new proposal on the table, so talk about that, including housing, which we definitely want to talk about. Russ, I always like to start this program by asking you what economic numbers or trends just have caught your attention in the past week or so. What are you really keeping an eye on, Russ?
Well, the big number that was a surprise was the job number nationally, which was minus 33,000. It's the first time in 84 months that the country has lost jobs. Now,
this is last Friday, right?
That's right. That 1 month does not make a trend. But it still was quite a shock to see minus 33,000 instead of plus 200,000 jobs a month, which has been the trend.
Now, a lot of people said those were hurricane-related.
Hurricane-related, yeah. I'm not sure that we dropped 175,000 jobs because of the hurricane, but that is what it's being attributed to.
Yeah.
The other thing is, really, all the major economic indicators are looking pretty good. Stock market's up, unemployment's low nationally and here in New Hampshire. New Hampshire's adding 12 to 14,000 jobs a year. But the lagging thing, and I know we're going to talk about it later in the show, is wages. And that's disappointing. If you look at the stock market and you go back to maybe 2007, 2008, the Dow Jones was at 6,000, almost 7,000. Now it's 22,000. It's tripled. Wages have been growing at about 2 or 3% a year. So investors are being rewarded in this economy, but workers aren't.
What other reports, headlines, economic numbers are you keeping an eye on, Jeff?
Well, actually, the numbers I was looking at were intriguing, but there weren't very many of them, and that was the numbers of associated with the Trump administration's tax cut plan, which really would be, if it was not a plan, it's a framework, and it would be quite a departure from recent American policy, certainly the Republican Party policy. And I'm just kind of curious to see how this is going to happen. I don't want to bring politics into this too much, but, you know, they have a pretty artificial deadline of before the end of the year. And it seems as if not much is going to happen, but it has stirred up a lot of debate on what is necessary to fix our whole tax system, which need some help.
Tax policy. So maybe that's the next economic roundup. We take a look at that from a New Hampshire perspective. Brian, what's been catching your eye lately?
A couple of things. One related to what Russ is talking about in terms of the national job picture. I'm really interested in seeing what happens with New Hampshire's numbers, which will be reported next week. There really has been a slowdown in hiring in New Hampshire in most of 2017. And another, I think, very important trend to watch, and I wrote about this back in June, is a trend of slowing state revenues, pretty significant slowing of state revenues, with one exception. I'd say rooms and meals taxes have held up very well. Those two things could be related, and I think that, you know, it's a real early warning. Next week we'll provide some more information, I think.
Sure. So the national numbers come out the first Friday of the month, and the New Hampshire numbers come out like a week or 10 days later.
Yeah.
Let me just do real quick on that. You said that hiring has slowed down here in New Hampshire. At least here in Concord, gosh, everywhere I go, I see help wanted, help wanted, help wanted, help wanted. I mean, no matter if it's a restaurant or a store or, you know, any other kind of business. So
yeah, I mean, it does seem to be contradictory, but when you look at the actual payroll employment numbers, there really has been very, very little growth over the last 7-8 months. A lot of those job openings that you hear about are replacement jobs. It may not necessarily be new growth. We know we're replacing a lot of workers in the workforce. That's a function of the demographics of our labor force. So it's a combination of job openings, which are both replacement and growth. And I think we're seeing more replacement than we are growth right
That's
now.
That's interesting. So in an older state, you have a higher rate of people retiring. So those jobs I see advertised everywhere are just filling that person who has left.
Not all of them, but certainly a good percentage of them.
Okay, Jeff.
Yeah, I was going to say that, I mean, this is, I guess it's maybe a little bit more anecdotal because I've heard several instances now, but I know of one restaurant that I frequent in Kentuckook that had to cut its hours. It's closed on Sunday. It closes early on Sunday and Monday because it has a sign that says we can't get help.
Wow.
And I've heard of several others now in other areas where people have these restaurants, in particular restaurants, that are just not able to be open as way they used to be or usually are because they don't have enough staff. Now this is I'm not making any other assumptions, but another fact that has really been driven home to me in the last several weeks, if not maybe the last couple of months, is the addiction crisis has really affected a lot of the workforce. And that also could be a reflection of this need for jobs at certain levels of employment, like you know, fast food restaurants and other things.
You guys did a
like
whole
that.
Seminar on that recently, right?
We did,
right.
It's really eye opening what the effect that this has had on the workforce in New Hampshire in particular.
Wow. Okay, go ahead, Russ.
I was just going to say, I think Brian's commenting on slower job growth, I think it's really a case where we've kind of hit the wall in terms of available labor force. I agree with what you said, Jeff. Everywhere you go, big box retailers, you look around, there's nobody there in terms of workers. There's plenty of shoppers, but not many. And I think we've kind of hit the wall where the labor force growth has not kept pace with job growth in the state. And maybe the reason hiring is slowing down is there's nobody to hire. So,
well, a little bit later, because we've got a couple of big topics we're going to talk about today. A little bit later, we'll kick off the wage discussion with Brian and the idea that Target, a big retailer, may raise its wages to $15. So we'll set that aside for the moment, but we will cover that later. A couple topics that we are going to cover in depth today. One is a proposal for a new private rail service serving southern New Hampshire, connecting southern New Hampshire with Boston. We're also going to talk about housing policy. And a little bit later, we're going to talk about the governor's new millennial council, which recently had its first meeting. So, by the way, if you're a millennial, what would you like this council to know? What would you tell it if you could attend a meeting and talk to the people there? You can join us with your questions and comments on any of these subjects that we're covering this hour. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, today on the Economic News Roundup, private passenger rail, housing and zoning, and a new millennial council. And so, Jeff, let's talk about private rail. I thought this was real interesting. We've talked about rail, you know, umpty bump times on this program, but never about this proposal. Reports of a private company that wants to connect Massachusetts and southern New Hampshire. So just give us the basics of this first, Jeff, please. Yeah. What's the physical layout? Where does it go from and where does it end up?
The company is called Boston Surface Railroad Company, which is kind of a throwback. Sounds like something from the 19th century.
Yeah, it does.
But they have a plan to run a line from Providence, Rhode Island to Worcester, Mass.
So no Boston.
That's right. It's just going to go that way. And then they realize that they earlier than I thought, they were going to run a line to Bedford, New Hampshire, on property that's adjacent to the airport. to the Manchester Boston Regional Airport. So basically, it seems like a plan that's going to link these three regional airports: the one in Providence, Worcester, and Boston. I mean, and Manchester, not avoiding Boston. And it's an interesting plan because, first of all, they say they have several million dollars in venture capital already invested in it. So someone with money to invest is thinking that it's going to be a profitable business, which kind of belies what we've been hearing from in New Hampshire all these years, that you can't make money, it's going to get all these subsidies. But apparently they're not going to be looking for subsidies. I think they will need to have some kind of help in terms of getting the railroad rights away from the Pan Am company, which owns the railroad rights away, and they haven't always been the easiest to deal with over the years.
So it's passenger rail, but it's not commuter rail?
It's going to be I don't think there's many commuters from Bedford to Worcester.
I know that's.
I mean, there might be, but
that's the thing I couldn't figure out. I know, like, it just, you know, first of all, Bedford.
But the other thing is that because it's going to be going to Bedford, the city of Nashua basically said if we build a train station there,
would you stop here?
Will you stop here? And that's said, oh, sure, you know, we'll do it if you build the station. So there will be, apparently, there'll be some kind of rail if this goes through from Bedford to Nashua, and that actually could be service some kind of a commuter rail in you know, for people who live in Bedford and work in Nashua, vice versa. But that's not exactly a big universe of people, I don't think.
What do you think of this, Russ? It's a little different. It's kind of a different line, and the funding is definitely a different model.
It's conceptually intriguing, but I don't think that the impact of it would be, significant. We've talked before about 120,000 commuters from New Hampshire to Massachusetts. The study that looked at rail from Concord to Boston said maybe 2,700 a day per workday would utilize Concord to Boston. So Bedford to Worcester, you have to say, it's not going to make a huge dent. I've done studies over the years on rail, and what it tends to do is transform the landscape where there's a station, for example, the Alewife station that opened up in Arlington, Cambridge, really transformed that neighborhood, and you get much higher density development than you had before. But is this going to really change the commute, make it shorter, make traffic less intense, reduce the need for investing in highways? Probably not.
Interesting. So it's a different approach in terms of what services it's going to provide. It's not, the idea is not, anybody can jump in here, the idea is not to sort of take, you know, office workers from Manchester down to their office jobs in Boston. And that's not the goal.
Yeah, and that's kind of a shame because I think that's what's really needed. One of the problems with most of the proposals to date is that there's very few public transit models that are profitable. So it needs a subsidy. People in New Hampshire don't want to subsidize a line that goes from Manchester to Boston. And my argument to that is that I think we all have a stake in making Manchester, which is our largest city, as viable as possible. You think of larger cities and states that have undergone a decline in their economic environment, Detroit, Cleveland for a long time, Pittsburgh. It doesn't reflect well on your state when your largest city isn't well connected and isn't as vibrant as possible. So even though we may not in Concord enjoy it as much or the benefits of it, we all benefit in some way if Manchester is vibrant.
I had an interesting conversation last week with several business people in the Seacoast area, and they were talking specifically about how the station in Dover, which Brian's very familiar with.
I walked there.
Yeah, and it's really become kind of a transportation hub, and there's housing being built nearby for people who work in Boston, and they can walk to the train station or take their bikes, and they do that, and they go to Boston for their job. And there's you know, it's we're not talking about thousands of people, but it is a convenience that people are seeing, and that's helping the city of Dover. Because it's really been going on a great rejuvenation, and that's part of the reason is having access to the Down Easter train that goes to Boston.
The phone number for you to join us on our New Hampshire Economic Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Right now, we're looking at a new proposal for private passenger rail. We're taking a look at where that would go, how it would be financed. A little bit later, we'll talk about New Hampshire's severe housing crunch and what might be behind that. And then we'll talk about the governor's new millennial council. We'd love to hear from you on that. What do you think this council needs to look at? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So guys, here's an email from Christopher in Manchester who says, things seem to be really happening in Bedford along South River Road and the Route 101, 114 interchange. Lots of new medical facilities, some retail, lots of apartments. The Market and Main project finally gets ready to go into full gear. Feels a bit like the 80s, but with smarter growth and planning. So, Christopher, thank you for the email. And this kind of fits into what we're talking about, Russ.
Yeah, it does. It fits in both in terms of maybe the ability to support a higher intensity development that can support rail. We've spoken before about Tuscan Village in Salem that I've been doing some work on, and that's looking at about 2 to 3 million square feet of commercial space just up the road, Woodmont Orchards in Londonderry, large development, Route 3 corridor in Bedford, as the caller mentioned. So we're seeing instead of this kind of sprawl growth, we're seeing a concentration and a mixture of land uses in large projects in southern New Hampshire now. And I think it's probably a good thing. It fits better with the way people want to live, not drive maybe 15 or 20 miles from a very rural setting into Concord, Manchester, Portsmouth, whatever. So kind of live, work, play all in your own backyard.
Well, here's a report or an analysis that came out recently about this private rail proposal from the Josiah Bartlett Center, cheering the idea that this is being done with private funding. And Josiah Bartlett says, if these plans materialize, New Hampshire will get commuter rail service from the greater Manchester area through Nashua to Lowell, where, Josiah Bartlett points out, riders can hop a train to Boston and on to Worcester, Mass. And Providence, Rhode Island at zero cost to taxpayers, and it will take the company less than a decade. So, you know, Jeff, we're looking at this going, Worcester, huh? Who wants to go to Worcester? But they're right. I mean, once you're in Worcester or Lowell, yeah, you can hop transit to Boston and
yeah,
other points.
Obviously you can do that. I was thinking that a logical thing also, if you wanted to go to New York City and south of there, you could, you know, it'd be easier to go by train that way, especially for people on this part of the, on the western part of the state. You know, you have the Downeaster already on the seacoast, and that would make it easier to get to New York. But in terms of commuting, I think it's not. I mean, I grew up on the subways in New York, and you know, when you make more than one switch, you just kind of go, "Oh, this is too much." So it's logical. You can do this, but I don't think that's not the kind of rail plan they talk about in terms of helping, like Brian was saying about Manchester.
Let's take a call, gentlemen. Thank you for the email, Christopher. And Joe's in Laconia. Hi, Joe. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
This is Charlie in Laconia.
Oh, Charlie, I apologize.
That's okay. And I have a cold, so please forgive my voice. I heard you talking about the Downeaster. If I drive to Boston, and I go to Boston a lot, for my doctors are down there, my dentist is down there, and I go for other reasons. It's a 200-mile drive round trip from Laconia. I have made it my goal, which I do as often as possible, to drive to Dover 50 miles, park my car there for a minimal amount of money, and take the Downeaster into Boston. And I avoid the worst part of my life, which is driving on Interstate 93. I don't care how wide they make it. It just is horrible.
Well, so, and Charlie, thank you for the call. And he's right in that my husband commutes in and out of Boston a lot. It's getting out of Boston. It's getting in and out of Boston. Right. He will sit there for 45 minutes sometimes, yeah, right, getting out of Boston. So go ahead. Praise for the Downeaster there,
yeah,
Brian.
Yeah, and it's not just, I love the Downeaster. It's one of my favorite things to do. But I also want to plug the bus service that's in my region out of Dover, which runs in the early morning commuting times every half hour and then every hour after that. We are very well connected over on the seacoast, and that's not something that you can say is true about a lot of places in the state.
But the buses do get stuck, though, in that Boston traffic.
They do, but it's still better than driving.
It's still better than driving. You can be on your laptop.
And I tell you, they are packed. They are full.
Yeah, they absolutely are.
It's also true down in Merrimack Valley also, that there's buses
right,
that
from
go.
Concord.
The Concord buses Concord. Are packed. Concord. The Portsmouth buses are packed. Yeah, I've been on those buses. They're comfortable, but they do get stuck.
It's all about connectedness.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Charlie. We will take more of your calls in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses.
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our New Hampshire Economic News Roundup. We're covering a couple big economic headlines recently. A proposal for private passenger rail linking southern New Hampshire with Worcester and Providence. A little bit later, we'll talk about housing and the lack of affordable housing, what role zoning might play. And then we'll cover the governor's new Millennial Council. It's a group aimed at attracting and keeping younger workers. And by the way, if you are a millennial, what would you like to tell this council? Let us know, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our economists are Jeff Feingold, Brian Gottlob, and Russ Thibault. And guys, let's wrap up this private rail proposal. Just one or two more questions about it. And I guess to you, Russ, I mean, is this a game changer, the idea of, you know, a private company finding private funding to do this privately? I mean, the big sticking point has been people in New Hampshire have been concerned that this might not be worth the tax money investment.
I think I don't know if it's a game changer, but it keeps the whole concept alive. And the state legislature kind of put the kibosh on additional studies for rail. And this sort of keeps it in the news, keeps it in our discussions. I think it's great that way. As I said, I don't think it's going to transform the commute at all, but I think it is very intriguing. If it can work financially from Bedford to Worcester, you start thinking, how about Bedford to Lowell?
Sure. So it opens up the conversation.
Yeah, it does. It keeps
but
it
new
going.
Models of funding. Because, yeah. Again, that's been the sticking point. It's a lot of public money, and people have said, not so sure.
Yeah, it's terrific. I think it's great to have that.
Jeff?
Yeah, actually, I agree with Russ. I think it's really important to bring the conversation, take it in a different direction than it has been, which is pretty much been yes, no. And you're just people just arguing with each other. Now we will actually, if this comes to fruition, see this is what happens when you have rail to Worcester and Providence. As Russ said, well, wait a second. If we had rail from Manchester to Boston, think about what that would be. And I think that does kind of change the dynamics of the debate at this point.
Yeah, so up until now, the debate has been A or B, yes or no. This brings in a C option. Maybe this is an option C.
It'll bring
us an example of what it looks like, you know, to have rail back in New Hampshire, which we actually had a lot of back in the day. But.
Right. And they have now on the seacoast, as Brian has been reminding us. And here's a question for you, Brian, that came in about the Downeaster on the seacoast. This is an email from Mark who says, I'd like to hear more discussion about the Downeaster. The line runs through Durham, where the ideas and knowledge workforce that power tomorrow already exist. Mark says, UNH just announced its desire to build a research park. I saw that headline this morning, where people can live, work, play, and learn. Can the guests speak about how directly connecting the flagship university more directly with the business community, taking advantage of a rail line that goes directly to Boston, can help the New Hampshire economy? He says a study by Biotechnology Innovation Organization showed a vibrant university-industry partnership added $1.1 trillion to the U.S. gross industrial output since 1996. Isn't this good for New Hampshire? Mark says, what about that connection between our sort of knowledge center at UNH, Brian, and the Downeaster connection to Boston, Maine?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about connectedness, and that means transportation, but it also means that connectiveness with the workforce and the intellectual capacity that's at UNH. There could be a lot more done. I've been involved in the Seacoast and economic development efforts for a long time, and one of the comments that I've had for the last 20 years is that most communities do not take advantage of their possible connections with the university and the talent there. The university provides an awful lot of resources to various communities in terms of talent, but most communities just don't think of themselves as being part of that network. And so a lot of it is occurring simply because it's the fault of local communities, but it would be a great thing.
Well, thanks for the email, Mark. Go ahead,
Russ.
We have a
lot of examples right in our backyard of collaboration between universities and the business community generating huge amount of jobs in Boston, MIT, Harvard, Northeastern. So I think it's true. The only thing I would say, Brian, is as a UNH alum, I feel it's not so much communities aren't taking advantage of the university, but rather the university isn't reaching out. I feel more connected to the University of North Carolina, where I got a graduate degree, than I do to the University of New Hampshire.
Now, why is that, Russ?
I don't know, but I don't know. But it's a kind of a pet peeve of mine that the university does. When I was at UNH as a, believe it or not, music major, every spring break, we used to go around, take the whole University of New Hampshire band out to communities in New Hampshire and play a concert one night here, one night there, stay with people. But I feel, Brian, you're right in the backyard of the university. I'm not that far away in Laconia, and I just don't feel the connection anymore. Hmm. Maybe I'm doing something wrong, but I don't sense the connection.
I am in the backyard, and I don't feel that connection okay. either, and I'm also a graduate. So.
Well, that's interesting, and we're planning, we're talking to UNH about getting President Huddleston in, who's stepping down. We'd love to sit down with him one more time before he moves on. So that's a question that we'll ask him. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, I was referring to this discussion I had with these business people on the seacoast, and one of the things they mentioned was that they were really pleased that there seems to be more of an effort made by the university in recent years to have more of a connection with the business community of the seacoast, specifically the seacoast, not just Portsmouth, not just Dover, but everything. And they are making these resources more available. This research park is a perfect example of that. That's, if it goes through, you're talking about having startups, existing businesses. It's kind of modeled after the North Carolina, actually.
Research Triangle.
And it could be a big thing for the university and for the state, but the thing is that the interesting thing was they said there's more interaction between the university, some of the university professors, and the chambers of commerce, believe it or not, where they actually have interactions, which really is that's much different than I know, because I've always heard the stories that Russ and Brian were talking about how there were no connections, but they're trying harder now.
Well, couple more comments from our listeners on our transportation discussion earlier, and again, pinging off of this private rail proposal. And then I do want to ask you guys about housing and wages and the Millennial Council. So here's an email from Virginia. She says, I believe I am correct that there are no buses that run to the Manchester airport. It is easier for me to get from Center Harbor to Boston by bus than it is to Manchester, which is my preferred airport. And getting east to west across the state is not possible at all. She says, why isn't this problem ever addressed? Wow, I guess we're going to talk a lot about transportation today. And, you know, having family, living in Concord, having family in Keene, Ginny, I feel your pain when it comes to east-west transportation. But who wants to address this Manchester Airport problem? I mean, she's right. It's easier to get to Logan than it is to Manchester Airport. Russ?
The airport is feeling the pinch, too. But departures are down.
Right.
And so I think that part of the reason why that's the case is that the Manchester Airport grew exponentially when they were doing the big dig in Boston, and the kind of impediments to conventional car and bus traffic were greater than they are now. The big dig project gets finished, and now it's almost easier to, as your caller said, for me, I'm the same. From Laconia, it's easier to get to the Boston airport than the Manchester airport.
Anything on the horizon to fix that? Thank you, Ginny, for the email.
Well, I mean, I know that where I'm in London, there's a bus that takes you right into the airport.
To Manchester airport?
Yeah, Manchester, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, you have to go through Concord, but you know, you can get there.
But it takes you directly.
The east-west is a big issue, really, transportation-wise. I mean, yes. I've spoken in Keene the last few years to an economic conference in Keene, and that's a wonderful community with a lot of really interesting things going on and a university. Yet, you know, if you live there, you can't take advantage of all of the economic activity that's happening just a little bit to the east. I mean, you can take advantage of it, but it's a lot harder to get from Keene to Concord to Manchester than it is from Portsmouth to Manchester.
And if you're on Route 9 and you're stuck behind a truck, oh boy.
Yeah,
having done that many times.
Transportation is a major issue over there.
And they shut down the rest area there, but that's another issue. Audrey on Facebook says, don't forget the Monadnock region. So there you go, Brian. Audrey says, it would be great to have commuter rail options in our area without having to go to Massachusetts. Audrey says, traffic and travel time to Nashua is more congested and longer than Fitchburg or Littleton, Mass. There are many in this area who commute to Boston or Cambridge. So, Audrey, thank you for that. Now, here's another comment on Facebook from Martha, who says, Laura, help. We're really struggling with hiring service industry employees. I cringe listening to the cheers for easier commuting to Boston for work when we don't have enough employees in our own state. Great point, Martha.
I look at that as kind of the Berlin Wall view of the labor market. Let's keep them in instead of allowing free access to and from. I'm a believer in the connectedness and that if you connect our cities with the southern part of the state, one of the things that it will do, it will invite more people into our region.
So people who might want that lovely, more, tree-lined lifestyle.
And we have experience with that in the seacoast where we are very, very connected. It has helped increase the labor force over there more than most parts of the state, and it's because there is that easy access. And eventually, businesses in New Hampshire can take advantage of that increase in size in the labor force.
Go ahead, Russ.
You know, Middlesex County, which is the border county in Massachusetts to the Nashua region, for example, has as many jobs as all of New Hampshire. So I think so. That means it's all those workers there too. So I think I agree with Brian. The interconnectedness of that of New Hampshire to Massachusetts is critical to the health of New Hampshire. And if you have rail, even though there will be people that are commuting to Massachusetts, it opens up another large labor market potentially available to the caller.
So Martha shouldn't worry about sort of
it's already happening. We're losing 120,000 a day to Massachusetts as it is. So
go ahead, Jeff.
The thing is, the reality is that when Boston and Massachusetts do well, New Hampshire does well. I mean, that's been a historical fact, and to deny that is just kind of not understanding how the economy works in New Hampshire. But the other thing is, you have to remember, people certainly in the Boston area, those jobs are paying 20% to 30% more than are being paid in New Hampshire, and You can't tell people, well, you have to stay in New Hampshire and earn less. We don't want you going to Boston. I mean, this is a reason people go down there. They get higher wages.
Well, lots to talk about with transportation. I'm going to turn a corner to housing and start with you, Jeff. New Hampshire Business Review had a headline recently. New Hampshire housing market sees more of same, low inventory, higher prices. What's behind that, Jeff?
Well, basically what it is that we have a housing market that's just stagnant in terms of getting the inventory out there in terms of the number of houses for sale. And also we have had a cap on the number of rental housing units we have.
I heard rental vacancy rates in some cities are, close to zero.
Yeah, and which is not good.
Unless you're a landlord.
Yeah, unless you're a landlord. Well, yeah, but even then it's probably not a good thing in the end. But, we're talking about average rents, including the whole state, including Coos County and Sullivan County, is well over $1,200 a month. In places like Portsmouth, it's much higher than that. Manchester as well, other bigger, larger, more urban areas. There's a notable lack of homes for sale in the lower price range, which is preventing people from moving from a rental to a house.
Starter homes, we used to call them.
Yeah. And, it's not, and because of that, prices are higher, and that's also preventing people from getting into a starter home. So what we're seeing is this is a continued trend. It's been going on for for a couple of years now, Russ, at least, right? I assume, or even longer. And this is really becoming a impediment to further growth in New Hampshire.
And maybe some of that hiring.
And also into attracting more people to come here to work.
Go ahead, Russ.
I was going to say that part of it, too, a lot of this is market dynamics. There's a lot of demand for housing right now. Interest rates are low. So housing for ownership is affordable. Rental, not affordable. But ownership housing is kind of affordable right now. But what I think part of the problem is that we're adding 12 to 14,000 jobs a year. We have been. Brian's comments notwithstanding. Typically, the ratio of new housing units to jobs is about 750 housing units for every 1,000 jobs. That's historically. So we should be building 8,000 to 10,000 new housing units a year in New Hampshire. We're building 2,000 to 3,000. So part of the problem is that we're not building enough housing to keep pace with kind of the job growth, which means we're not attracting new workers in. They don't have no place to go. And I think part of the reason for that is that we have an obsolete set of development controls, zoning. It's been shown nationally by reputable researchers that if you have intense development controls, it affects housing prices to the tune of maybe 20% higher than if you don't have strong development controls. Now, we need good development controls.
Well, right, because you need to keep the water clean. You need to you know, not create traffic. I mean, there are reasons for those.
There's a lot of
controls.
Reasons, but do we need 5-acre zoning? Do we need a $10,000 to $12,000 impact fee if you're building a new single-family home in the state? There's a lot of, do we need to keep it so that if you build a subdivision in a community, you can only sell 3 lots a year? So I think that a lot of these development controls came into play when we were building 20,000 housing units a year, and the problem was we were growing too fast. Now you could make a case that we're probably, in terms of the housing inventory, not growing fast enough. And we still have this sort of bank of development controls, 200-page zoning ordinances in small communities that I think we should look at and see, is some of this overkill?
What do you think, Brian?
Well, a couple of things. One, if you got rid of all those development controls tomorrow, one thing that you could be sure that you would do is that you would reduce the value of the existing stock of housing pretty significantly.
It's about balance.
No, explain that, Brian.
Well, because one of the effects of controls of zoning and those kind of residential restrictions is that it keeps housing prices higher, and it does contribute to their cost. If you remove those and you allow a lot of new housing to be built at a much lower cost, what will happen is those existing homes, the value of those existing homes will fall. So we'll all feel a little bit worse off if we have our if we already own a home. But for me, a larger issue is I went last night and I looked at a bunch of communities to see what their average median housing price on the market is. In Concord, it's $279,000. In Claremont, it's $139,000. In Berlin, it's $84,000. In Manchester, it's $237,000. In Portsmouth, it's $650,000.
Wow.
In my community, Dover, it's $399,000. Now, residential restrictions and controls, regardless, that doesn't account for that difference of $650,000 in Portsmouth and $237,000 in Manchester. That's a function of the market, as Russ mentioned. There's stronger demand in those communities. There's very strong economies for the most part. They're very desirable because of the amenities that they have, and that's the biggest contributor to the issue of why housing prices are so high. And just as one last comment, it's a problem. Housing prices have been killing New Hampshire's economy, according to a lot of people, for 30 years, ever since I came here in the 1980s.
So it's a problem, but not go overboard.
I just wanted to say that when Russ was talking about 2,000 new units are being built, residential units are being built each year, most of those, I would argue, are higher end. They're higher priced. For the marketplace, for people who are looking for a starter home, for people who are looking for a rental unit, there's a limited inventory. Limited inventory. In some cases, there's none. And when you talk about the zoning, ways of inhibiting the growth, in many cases, you have cities and towns, specifically many towns, that basically try their best to leave out what we call affordable housing, workforce housing. They won't allow it. So they have these exclusionary zoning laws. And that's the problem. It's not so much saying we want to be able to build instead of a 5-acre lot, let us build on a 2-acre lot. That's not it. They're just not letting him build the housing that has more high density. So it could be more affordable. That's the real problem that the builders are seeing.
Well, I want to ask you one more question about that after a short break, because the legislature got involved in that affordable housing issue about a decade ago. So we can talk about that real quick. And then we should turn, gentlemen, to the governor's new millennial council, some of the issues that it's tossing around. We'd love to hear from you as well. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back. It's the Economic News Roundup today in The Exchange, where we look at some of the top economic headlines around New Hampshire recently. We've looked at a new proposal for private passenger rail connecting southern New Hampshire with Massachusetts. We've also been talking about zoning laws and the impact on housing availability, housing prices. In just a few minutes, we'll look at the governor's new Millennial Council. This is a group aimed at attracting and keeping younger workers. So, by the way, if you are of the millennial generation, what would you like to tell this council? What do you think it should know? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, gentlemen, just to wrap up our housing conversation, and Jeff, I'll turn to you. Most housing policy, correct me if I'm wrong, is set locally, right, by zoning boards, planning boards, councils and so forth. But I got this from New Hampshire Business Review, Jeff. In 2008, after years of debate, the legislature required municipalities to comply with a court decision by providing, quote, reasonable and realistic opportunities for the development of workforce housing, including rental and multifamily housing. So a decade ago, Jeff, the legislature did get involved in this. How effective has that involvement been?
Well, we're still talking about it. So.
Yeah.
Well, one of the problems is that it was 2008, and if you just look at historically, what we entered into the worst recession we'd had in decades, and that didn't help. But there's been some movement in certain communities to build more multifamily housing, which is really, I think, the biggest concern of employers.
Multifamily means rental apartment.
Yeah. And it's moving a little bit, but it's been very, very slow. And the legislature says it's almost like a suggestion to the communities. It's not like saying we're going to put you in jail if you don't do this.
So. Yeah, the language is pretty loose. Yeah. Reasonable, realistic opportunities. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can.
You can drive a bus through that one.
Yeah.
One of those buses going out of Boston.
There have been in some communities, you've got to kind of pat them on the back. They've done a better job than others. Londonderry, for example, yes, has probably 500 multifamily units, of which 25% are designed to be affordable in order to get a density. Londonderry's done a good job.
What is affordable? I mean, isn't that kind of subjective, too? What's affordable for me might not be affordable for you.
No, actually, they do have a mathematical measurement of it, which is it should be affordable to people earning 80% of the median income in your county. So paying no more than 30 or 35% of their income for rent. So you can do the math, and there's actually printed rent, maximum rents allowed for affordable and still be considered affordable housing, county by county, year by year in New Hampshire.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Ben who says, housing comment from a millennial here. Ben says, on the older end, a ex-millennial, if you will. Gen X, I guess so. Ben says, family-friendly housing is a big problem. If you have three kids and can't afford $200,000 for a house, you will easily pay $1,800 a month in rent on the low end. Wow, that's a lot, Ben. Go ahead, Brian. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think it gets at some of Russ's comments about the rental market. The rental market, in a lot of ways, I think is where a bigger challenge is in terms of affordable housing. There are plenty of places, I think, where you can buy a relatively affordable home. It may mean that your commute is longer. That's much less true, I would say, on the rental end.
Yes.
Let's take another call. And thank you for that Facebook comment, Ben. James is in Concord. Hi, James. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead, James.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I was wondering if you guys have any comments on other alternate housing options, things like small houses, agro housing. There's a lot of people who are in single-family homes or, an apartment that would fit a single family, and they're not going elsewhere because they don't see anything different than what they have, and they'd like to get into these things, but they don't know how to start them. I recently moved to New Hampshire and Concord. My wife and I recently purchased a farm in Concord, and we have 130 acres, and we're looking very seriously at how do we provide housing options that aren't things that you see out there right now, but are things that people are really interested in.
Like offering rental on your own property, James? Is that what you're talking about? Or
Well, so we're an active farm, and we want to stay an active farm, but it's really hard to pay the bills as an active farm without having people coming to your property. And the state's recently done a lot of work on agritourism, which gives us the ability to bring in people
sure.
to the farm for things that aren't necessarily just, you know, buying vegetables. They can stay on the farm and watch us grow vegetables.
Right, or so you can hold weddings or whatever.
Great.
Well,
weddings, things like that. But we're looking, you know, we've had people approach us and say, hey, I really want to have a small house and or a small house on wheels that I can take someplace, but I don't have the money to get a big piece of property, and there's no place out there unless I want to go park it in a mobile home park.
Can I put it on your big, beautiful farm in Concord?
Right.
Interesting. Okay, thank you for calling. And another less interesting model, but I live in the neighborhood right near UNH Law, so a lot of old houses in my neighborhood, and fair number of people right around me, you know, have figured out how to change up their housing, and they live in one part and they rent out the other part to a law student. So that's another sort of way of getting around this housing stock that might not fit us quite right, kind of like that pair of pants that you try on and doesn't quite fit right anymore. Go ahead, Russ.
We have a lot of 3- and 4-bedroom housing units in New Hampshire, and we have a lot of 1- and 2-person households.
Right.
So there's sort of a mismatch between the existing inventory and our households. Actually, you talked about the legislature back in 2008. More recently, they did pass an accessory dwelling ordinance that encourages, allows introduction of an additional non-related person in a single-family home in much of the state. So that's sort of beginning to address that issue. But there's a lot more. A lot of communities have minimum lot sizes, minimum housing sizes. The minimum lot size of 5 acres, if you're doing a development, it means a very expensive lot. You're probably looking at minimum of $80,000 to $100,000.
So if you want to be creative and approach it from a different way, like James is and like I talked about, sometimes it works depending on your city or town, and sometimes it doesn't.
I think that's true.
Thank you so much for the call. Go ahead, Brian.
No, I'm good.
agree.
I just wanted to add one thing, that we have a piece on our website by an executive of Fannie Mae, and they're starting up a program in New Hampshire. Actually, I started it last month, that's providing mortgages to manufactured housing. That would make it easier. The Fannie Mae will actually buy the mortgage, which will open up a much bigger market. And it's available only in New Hampshire. New Hampshire's the first state to be doing this.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that is a possibility on James's farm.
Okay, James, thank you so much. And Betty's in Londonderry. Hi, Betty. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi there. We're retirement age, and we have a very nice house. It's not a mansion, but you know, we're getting tired of taking care of the house, and we wouldn't mind moving into a higher density, nice quality housing where maybe some amenities are there. And I know there's a lot of vacant land in New Hampshire, but you don't see any encouragement for like Toll Brothers or these major builders to come in here and start building places that people would like to maybe stay in New Hampshire, not feel compelled to go to Florida or North Carolina and have a nice retirement here. But they still don't want to take care of their house.
Well,
and
that's
nothing,
yeah.
Know, and people would move up into those houses.
So looking to downsize, couple. Betty, but nothing really available. This is the crunch that I've heard about, Brian. You can correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, younger people, millennials wanting to buy that first starter house, older people like Betty wanting to downsize, also buying a smaller house. And so there's not a lot of smaller
And I think that there is efforts to address it. At least over in my part of the state, I see a lot of retirement, near retirement communities being built. And that's another issue, because you have a lot of people complaining about that. That's what's being built. But, you know, my point on that issue has always been that when you build that, most of the time it's for people who are looking to move out of their existing home. And that opens up another house for a younger family. So it is occurring. It may not be occurring in the collars part of the state, but at least over in the seacoast, there's a lot of those kinds of developments.
Gosh, in Londonderry, it seems to be booming down there.
Sure.
So, yeah. Okay, well, good luck, Betty. Go ahead, Russ.
Well, communities have been welcoming age-restricted housing until this year.
But maybe Betty doesn't want age-restricted. Maybe she just wants a smaller house in a neighborhood with kids and babies and, you know, young families and so forth. Some people don't want to be demographically isolated.
It doesn't have to be age-restricted, but the communities have been giving bonuses, higher density allowed for age-restricted housing. It's been much easier to get approval for. But my point is, that seems to be starting to change in communities across some communities. One, at least in New Hampshire, is saying, enough.
Wasn't that
right.
Plastow?
Pelham.
Plastow or Pelham?
Yeah, we talked about that last time.
We did.
On the roundup. Okay, so we should turn to the Millennial Council, because That was a big headline just a week or two ago. It held its first meeting, got some attention. Jeff, what's the Millennial Council?
Well, the Governor Sununu set up this council because he talked a lot about this on the campaign trail while he was running about the need to listen to millennials in New Hampshire. What do they want to that will make them stay here? Because we've had a major problem, as we've talked about most of this show. It's touched on this issue of younger people leaving the state for opportunities. So he put together this panel of millennials who basically applied to become members, and they had a meeting. And apparently it was pretty fruitful, but it's you know they're supposed to come up with a report on December 1st. So we'll see, that's really what we're looking for. They'll have another at least one more meeting, and they're actually taking feedback from people, other millennials, saying you know tell us what you want to hear. But I don't know. I mean I don't know what they're going to accomplish. I one thing that was very interesting is a report on public radio where one of the millennial council members from the Keene area. Was saying that they have different issues involving, you know, what they would like to see as opposed to people on the seacoast in Manchester.
Sure, so in the North Country.
Just kind of saying millennials want this.
Right.
It depends on the location.
It's like seeing everybody you know, age 50
yeah, so
wants this.
It's an idea. You say, well, yeah, I'm trying to do something about it, and I don't know where it's going to get us.
I mean, I just find this topic fascinating. Millennials.
As the father of three millennials.
I own three
speaking
millennials.
With authority.
I own three millennials at one time. Now I'm just kind of responsible for their upkeep and maintenance.
monthly.
Yeah. But, you know, they're the largest by numbers generation that we've ever had. I mean, they're bigger than the baby boom generation.
Really? I didn't
yeah.
know that.
So I find it very interesting that we feel like we're somehow going to have to cater to their needs. They're going to be telling us, they're going to be what their interests are, their likes, their wants, just like the baby boom, how we catered to the baby boom. They're going to be determining all of our cultural, almost all of the tastes that we have in the country. I look at quinoa, kale and tiny houses as evidence of what millennials want and us catering to their needs. But more directly, look, New Hampshire is not, it's not monolithic. There are a lot of communities that are very attractive to millennials that have done a good job. You know, I've looked at the age progression in New Hampshire of every community and how they've aged over the last three decades. And you can see some communities are not aging the way the public debate seems to talk
sure.
about. And it's because they offer. You can go into any community in New Hampshire and know whether they'll be attractive to millennials.
So give us an example. And by the way, in an earlier economic roundup, Brian, Russ talked a lot about the aging of the lakes region.
Right,
where are the hotspots for millennials in New Hampshire?
Well, the seacoast is certainly one. And, you know, Portsmouth has been. For a long time, Portsmouth was a much older community. It's an expensive community. It still is an expensive community. But my community in Dover, Newmarket, which is, and a lot of it has to do with housing, but it's not necessarily inexpensive housing. It's the right kind of housing. It's access to the cultural, the civic, the social amenities, the coffee shops, the restaurants.
The microbrews.
Right. To be able to live and, yeah, exactly. To, you know, in Dover, they've built a lot of housing in the downtown area where people, you know, they live there, but then in the evenings, they can have some entertainment in the downtown area. That's true in Newmarket. There's plenty of communities that have done this. So my concern is we look at this as a statewide issue, and it's really about local choices and the choices that locals will make.
Go ahead, Russ. Yeah.
Brian's right that there's a lot of diversity within the state. But if you take the maybe 20,000-foot view, it is still true, Brian, that all of our population growth over the next decade statewide is expected to be over age 65. We have a problem. I think that it's a problem that is partly lifestyle preferences, maybe not fitting exactly, other than in some isolated communities. But statewide, we have an issue about young people leaving and not coming back. They used to leave. I left and came back. You did, Laura, I know. Probably most of us, many of us that were born in New Hampshire, went away, kind of got our groove, and then came back. The part of the problem is they're still leaving, but they're not coming back. So statewide,
But my point is that that's a community issue. Communities can take actions that will make themselves much more attractive. That's why I say you go into any community in New Hampshire and you can immediately sense whether this is going to be a place that will attract millennials. And so I, rather than take a look at the statewide issue and assume it's a statewide issue, look at what can be done at the local level and be helping communities at the communities do what they need to do to attract
So look at those places where there have been successes,
right.
And
we've
say,
got
okay.
Models. We've got models out there. It's not, we
here
don't
already.
Need to scratch our heads.
Well, you know, right. Actually, we have one right here in Concord. I mean, Concord really has done a lot to improve its downtown. And my wife and I were just out to dinner the other night, and it's there's a lot of night. There's people walking the streets at night at 10 o'clock in Concord, and I don't mean, well, you know, they're enjoying themselves. That's somewhere else. But you know, they're there for entertainment. They've been out to dinner. They've gone to bars and all that stuff. That wasn't in Concord just a few years ago. Concord's made a specific attempt to do this. That's true. And Manchester has done this. Nashua has been doing it. Portsmouth, obviously, Dover. But there are communities where they just have not done this, and they're just kind of saying, why aren't they coming here? Well, you have to make some kind of attempt to say, well, look, this is, you know, they at some point, you know, a community has to say, what can we do, instead of just waiting for some kind of edict from on
high.
So
should we not bother having a millennial council? I mean, is it not a valuable exercise
to talk to
people? And
well, I think it's good because of the geographical diversity of the council. So people
yes.
from different
country,
areas
Lakes
can say,
region,
well, this is what the people in the Manadoc, this is what the Lakes region. And you know, because it's going to, the people in the Merrimack Valley in Nashua and Manchester, I'm sure, are going to say, we want rail. And then that's going to be a big deal. But how is that going to help someone in Berlin or Keene or whatever? But this, so you listen, you can hear what the different millennials will have to say about where they are.
Okay.
So it's a statewide issue with local solution.
Great way to put a ribbon on it, Russ. Guys, thank you so much. There's a couple other topics that we left on the table. We'll pick them up next time. I really appreciate you all coming in. Brian, it was really nice to see you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Laura.
Brian Gottlob, principal of Polycon Research, economic research firm based in Dover. Russ Thibault, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Laura.
Russ Thibault, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm based in Laconia. And Jeff Feingold, we'll talk again. Thank you.
It's great being here, Laura.
Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, gun rights, gun control. After the Las Vegas massacre, the debate over guns is back in Congress and in the Granite State. And this time, there may be a narrow area of agreement, banning or regulating a device called a bump stock that accelerated gunfire in the most recent mass shooting. Still, vast differences of opinion remain. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 7 p.m. on NHPR.
Next at 10 o'clock on NHPR, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from North Branch Construction, specializing in commercial, residential, institutional, and sustainable construction since 1958, on time, on budget, and at northbranch.net. And Keene State's Red Ferns Center, presenting Sue Me with her blend of jazz and R&B on October 12th. Information at keene.edu.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at NHPR.